This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Balls. Well, the spread of the Indian variant is putting at risk the further steps in our unlockdown roadmap. Katie, just explain what's happening.
So today marks the penultimate or allegedly penultimate lockdown easing. You are back being able to dine indoors. You can hug someone, though if you are going to do so, depending on what minister you listen to, you should do so responsibly and not go over the top. And then also there are a limited number of foreign getaways, I think mainly Portugal, and some journalists who have managed to not record this podcast and instead get their publication to send them on a break, not at the Spectator. But bigger picture is, for all that, I think the good news in that, in terms of businesses, some of whom have been closed now for 6 months, ultimately, there is a cloud over this, which is ultimately what happens on June 21st. So on the media round with Kwasi Kwarteng this morning, the question really being, can June 21st go ahead? Now, I think in all truth, no one actually knows the answer to that question yet in terms of what the government plans to do, because even those in government don't know what they're going to do because they need to wait to see how the data plays out. But we are seeing a big drive in places where the Indian variant has been on the rise. So in the northwest, in places like Bolton, for a surge in vaccinations, and also a push with this door-to-door effort to try and encourage those who are hesitant about getting the vaccine to take it. Because one of the things we have heard about over the weekend from ministers is the fact that when it comes to the, for now, I think fairly modest uptick in hospital admissions in those areas, the vast majority are people who have not had the vaccine but were eligible for it. And I think that's where the focus is. So can you get to the point where this doesn't become a spike or a spread out because it is not putting pressure on hospitals in the way that previous waves had, because there have been a lot of vaccinations now.
James, how is the cabinet dividing on this? Are we back in the hawks and doves territory, or is it a little bit more complicated than that?
Not quite yet. I think the situation looks more hopeful, I think, than it did on Friday evening. I think, A, the observational study that Ross Clark has written up on the Spectator website from India, suggesting that the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine is effective against this variant, plus Sir John Bell at Oxford suggesting that their lab work is showing something similar. So I think the nightmare scenario of a vaccine-evading variant hasn't yet happened yet. And I think we will see this in the next week or so over the data, is how much more transmissible is this variant and what that means. I also think that everyone fixating on the date of June 21st is at risk of missing another element of the picture, which is there are two very different versions of June 21st. One version of June 21st sees the 1 meter rule go, masks go everywhere, but poorly ventilated public transport, people told that they can go back to the office, regardless of whether that's completely essential for their work or not. The second version of June 21st sees, the 1 meter rule remain in place, which would obviously mean that lots of pubs and restaurants would have to carry on operating below capacity. People urged to carry on working from home if they can, still wearing masks in shops and when you're not actually sitting down and eating in a restaurant. So I think there are different shades of June 21st as well as the date itself. I think the big question is, how fast can you increase the number of vaccinations? And I really recommend Tom Whipple's piece in the Times on Saturday about this. There is a debate about whether this virus seems to be more transmissible. It's hard to know how much more transmissible it is, because at the moment it's been located, clustered in the UK in certain places where there are, for example, more multi-generational households. There are more people living in one home. And so that could suggest a sociological reason rather than a virological reason for the increased transmission rate.
Katie, where are Conservative MPs on this? Are they getting agitated again?
Well, I think because it's still early days, what we have are a few warning shots from backbench MPs, but I think it would have to go to the point where the government looked as though it was about to pause June 21st, water down their plans to really see the scale of any revolt. And also, for now, it is the usual suspects, so to speak. You have Steve Baker over the weekend writing a piece about how the government should hold their nerve and press on. You have Mark Harper, head of the COVID recovery group, making the point that if this is about vaccine hesitancy, you can't expect the majority of the public who have gone along with the vaccination programme to be held back from those who have been offered a vaccine and have refused it. That is their choice, but it cannot affect others in the same way. I think Andrew Lloyd Webber, not in the government or a Tory MP.
Tory peer.
But Tory peer. So perhaps there's a peer revolt too. Andrew Lloyd Webber has been out on the airwaves and making a similar point to Mark Harper, using, I think, slightly less kind language. But I think it is adding to the sense that ultimately there will be unrest. But I think it comes to a few different factors. So what does the data look like when the government plans to make this decision? I think that, as with most things, you have your MPs, who are the most active on this and always have been in the COVID recovery group, very reluctant for any change, any watering down from pure normality. And then I think the base that really matter in terms of the government making its plans, its majority of 80 and just general the mood of the party, I think fairly pragmatic, and therefore if we start to seeing an uptick or pressure on hospitals, that could mean that people are more supportive of a change. But if generally speaking it's just about a rise in cases and there isn't a direct correlation or a significant one in terms of pressure on the NHS, I think it'll be a hard sell with a lot of Tory MPs to change June 21st.
I think there's also an interesting irony here, which is the COVID recovery group are also particularly opposed to vaccine passports and the idea that there would be certain activities only open to the vaccinated and the non-vaccinated. I think that argument is going to come back now in the current circumstances, because I think you will see people beginning to argue, well, hang on a second, would it not make sense to keep people who have chosen to not have the vaccine out of places where the virus is particularly likely to transmit? And that is going to become a bigger part of the argument. But I think it's important we keep this in context, which is, polling out today from YouGov again shows that, you know, 90% of the population want to have the vaccine. That puts the UK higher than any other large country. And I also think at the moment it looks like that vaccine hesitancy has progressively been reducing among all groups as time has gone on. And so if that continues, I think that, you know, that there would be less of an argument for any kind of vaccine certification for kind of everyday life.
Moving on to another topic, Katie, Lord Frost has made some quite striking comments on the Northern Ireland Protocol today, saying that it won't last for very long. What does he mean by that?
Yes, I think there was a big upping of the ante on the UK side this weekend. One in a piece by David Frost in the Mail on Sunday, but also briefing to the Sunday Telegraph, and ultimately saying that the Northern Ireland Protocol in its current form would be dead in the water unless the EU move. Now, this is all ahead of marching season, which is in July, and what the government is suggesting is that if the Northern Ireland Protocol is not improved for the unionist community, you are going to see inflamed tensions, and they cannot predict where that would lead. And there's some talk of, would that mean that you could trigger Article 16, which we saw the EU do or think about doing on vaccines, because you would say it's about, you know, it was necessary for various reasons for people living in Northern Ireland. I think there's two sides to it. I mentioned the marching season, but the point that David Frost made in his piece was about, he cited a delicatessen, saying that it is now the case that it is impacting the everyday lives of those living in Northern Ireland, because lots of UK businesses are just not bothering, particularly smaller companies, to send things to Northern Ireland to supply because of the level of complication with the checks on goods. Now, this is the point where we say, well, they did sign up to this, but the UK side will say, we didn't expect them to enforce the checks in the way they are. And actually, if you compare it to how they're enforcing checks elsewhere, they think they're trying to make a point of it and making it as difficult as possible. But still not even, I think, in the full fat version of the Northern Ireland Protocol, because there's still various grace periods, even if they have been applied unilaterally by the UK side. But it clearly isn't working. I think the question is, will David Frost's tactics mean that the EU move? From what I hear, the EU is pretty enraged and surprised by the movements by the UK side this weekend.
James, on Friday, you wrote about the election of Edwin Poots as the new DUP leader. Just explain how the dynamics will change because of that.
So Evan Peets will be leader of the DUP. He won't be the first minister, but that also won't be Arlene Foster. She has said that she will resign from that role once the programme of centenary events for Northern Ireland is finished. I think where that has an impact is, on the one hand, he shows the kind of the strength of unionist opposition to the protocol. The fact that the protocol has done for Arlene Foster as both leader of the DUP and first minister of Northern Ireland is obviously a sign of the ways in which the protocol is destabilising unionist politics in Northern Ireland, certainly. But I also think that Peets is a difficult choice for the union in general, because I think he will make the DUP more the political wing of evangelical Protestantism than it has been previously. And while as, and he's also quite clearly aiming to kind of go, the DUP have been losing votes in two directions, some to the traditional unionist voice, who are a more hardline unionist party, more adamantly against the protocol and all its forms, but also to the Alliance. You know, of people who voted for the Alliance in 2019, 18.6% of them had voted for the DUP in 2017. I suspect that Peets will accelerate that transfer of votes to the Alliance because of the nature of his social conservatism and his kind of views on inclusivity and the like. But that then raises the prospect that at the next Assembly elections, Sinn Féin might be the largest party. Now, because of the changes made in the St Andrews Agreement, that would then lead to Sinn Féin having the right to nominate the First Minister. And I think it's very hard to see how power sharing could survive a Sinn Féin First Minister at Stormont, even though the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister have equal power. I just think that psychologically, unionism would find that very hard to accept.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie, and thank you for listening.